I think it would be appropriate for me to say how grateful I am for the privilege of participating in a council such as this. The blessing has been mine through these past days in listening to the papers that have been presented. And it has been a climax. It's been a highlight for me. I have enjoyed it. I have learned much. And I trust that my contribution to this council will also be something that will be of great profit to everyone. Turning to the preface remark that I make in the paper, the recent reemergence of the Sabbath debate among Baptists, who trace their theological lineage in one degree or another to the Protestant Reformation, especially in soteriological matters, has necessitated a fresh investigation of the twin subjects of the Sabbath and the Lord's Day. It will be the purpose of this paper to contribute to this discussion by surveying the roots of modern Sabbatarianism, particularly as it relates to Baptists in England and America, and to submit a study of one of the most significant texts in the epistolary literature of the New Testament, which bears upon the subject of the continuing validity of the Sabbath under the New Covenant. Chapter 1 is entitled A Historical Survey of the Rise of Modern Sabbatarianism. The roots of the modern Sabbath debate reach back to the 16th and 17th centuries in England. The Protestant Reformation had provided the seed plot out of which eventually grew several different views of the Christian day of worship in the light of the Old Testament Sabbath. The two most important in England in the two centuries following the Reformation were what have come to be called the ecclesiastical and Sabbatarian interpretations of the Lord's Day. The former was the position of the Church of England, while the latter became identified with Puritanism. The ecclesiastical interpretation states that the Sabbath was not an ordinance enjoined on man at creation, but was first revealed to the Jews immediately prior to the giving of the Decalogue at Sinai. It was a Jewish ceremonial ordinance, the sign of the Mosaic covenant, and lasted only until the expiration of the Jewish dispensation. The Lord's Day does not represent the continuation of the Sabbath in this dispensation, but is instead a purely Christian institution, appointed by the Church at the end of the first, or perhaps even in the second century. It has little, if anything, to do with the fourth commandment, and is only a positive ordinance of the Church, not dependent for its sanction on either the Old or New Testaments. I cite in the footnote that the elements of this view can be traced back to the very beginning of the Reformation in England. This book is not extant so far as I know. You can only find it on microfilm, but Peter Halen has written a two-volume work, The History of the Sabbath. He was an Anglican in the 17th century, in which he traces this view back to the very beginnings of the Reformation in England. By contrast, the Sabbatarian interpretation affirms that the Sabbath is a binding ordinance on man throughout human history because it was instituted at creation. Furthermore, the fourth commandment of the Decalogue merely codified in the eternal moral law of God what had been kept by the patriarchs from earliest times. And since the seventh day and one day in seven are synonymous expressions, the day could be changed while still preserving the Sabbath of the fourth commandment. Such a change of day occurred when Christ, through his apostles, replaced the seventh-day Jewish Sabbath with the first-day Christian Sabbath, also known as the Lord's Day. In the early years of the 17th century, the conflict between these two positions became the most visible point of difference between the two major parties in English Protestantism, Puritans and Anglicans. As J.H. Primus observes, the Sabbath dispute took the place earlier occupied by the dispute over vestments and other ceremonies and by the Presbyterian issue. By the turn of the century, Sabbatarianism had become the badge of Puritanism. One early Puritan, Edmund Calamy, spoke of a minister who carried Puritanism in his very name. And who was this minister? Sabbath Clark. Modern scholarship is agreed that the rise of Puritan Sabbatarianism is traceable to a combination of historical factors, though there is a disagreement as to which are primary and which secondary. You can cite the footnote to observe works that give varying interpretations of that evidence. In general, it may be said that theological, ecclesiastical, economic, and social forces present in 16th and 17th century England all converged to provide the soil out of which the Puritan Sabbath sprang. Wenton Solberg summarizes, "The new doctrine, that is the Sabbath, was the product of forces that were transforming England at the dawn of the modern era. Though basic to what occurred, Calvinism was by no means solely responsible. Had it been, a similar development should have taken place in Reformed centers on the continent, where such was never the case. Holland and Switzerland imported the English doctrine, but applied it less rigorously. And in France and Hungary, the Reformed minorities lacked the capacity to impose the English Sunday upon their countrymen. Not Calvinism alone, then, but Calvinism interacting with basic economic and social forces accounts for the rise of the Puritan Sabbath. Economically, dramatic changes in the direction of capitalism were introduced under the Tudors. The sale of confiscated monastery lands contributed to changes in land ownership and a rapid restructuring of classes. With the establishment of English maritime supremacy by the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588, the Tudor policy of encouraging overseas trade and expansion met with new success. Merchants opened trade in other parts of the world and accumulated capital, which enhanced their position in society and provided a base for other economic undertakings. According to J.U. Neff, the period from approximately 1540 to 1640 was also marked by a rapid industrial expansion, which reached its peak during the latter half of Elizabeth's reign and the reign of James I. The introduction of a series of capitalistic industries virtually unknown in England prior to the Reformation, and the parallel development and application of new technology combined to produce an industrial expansion which gave England worldwide fame by 1640. This commercial and industrial growth gave rise to the development of a middle class, thus creating pressure on the existing social structure. Social patterns began to be questioned, and the rise of an industrial society with its emphasis on production required a clearer definition of the periods of work and rest. This requirement came into direct conflict with the plethora of holy days on the church's calendar. These festivals were very numerous in pre-modern England, totaling about 165 days a year. The Reformation and the rise of capitalistic industrial society fed an appetite for change, and in 1552, authorities reduced the number of holidays to 79. Puritans included the suppression of holy days in their demand for reform, and in the Convocation of 1563, came within one vote of achieving their purpose. Responding to the Puritan assault on holy days, Archbishop Whitgift, in reply to Thomas Cartwright, defended the church's schedule of holy days as honoring to God and edifying to men. In relation to the fourth commandment, he argued that while one day of rest was commanded, 6 days of labor were only permitted. By contrast, William Perkins, whom Christopher Hill describes as the first systematic Calvinist theologian in England, who also had a clearly defined attitude toward social problems, advanced the notion that the fourth commandment not only permits but requires labor on 6 days, and so he urged Parliament to declare 6 days as work days while prohibiting Sunday labor. Thus, in one sense, the Puritan Sabbath, with its attendant emphasis on 6 days of labor, was the definition of the use of time which the newly industrialized society was looking for and could assimilate to its advantage. But while economic and social factors played a part in the development of Puritan Sabbatarianism, theological and ecclesiastical factors were unquestionably more directly determinative. The summarization of these factors begins in the first half of the 16th century with the migration of Anabaptists from the continent to England because of persecution. Although precise information is lacking, says G.H. Williams, it is certain that the Anabaptists of Dutch and Flemish origin were present in some strength in England prior to 1536. These Anabaptists brought with them the view, based on Paul's writings, that one day should not be regarded above another in importance, and that any distinction of days true under the Mosaic covenant was ceremonial, and therefore has been fulfilled in Christ. Apparently fearful that this Anabaptist error either had or might promote an even greater disregard of Sunday, the Church of England acted to ensure the sanctity of the Lord's Day among the English people. I would have you turn back to page 7, to note footnote 14, where it says the preamble to the Act of Uniformity of 1552 declared that a great number of people in diverse parts of the realm do willfully and damnably refuse to come to their parish churches. Now, while this language probably reflects a general indifference to worship on the part of the English, the knowledge of the Anabaptist position could easily have been enlisted as a reinforcement to their already practiced negligence. In 1552, under the influence of Thomas Cranmer and Nicholas Ridley, a revised edition of the Book of Common Prayer was issued, which required the public reading of the Ten Commandments every Sunday. After each commandment, the congregation was to respond, "Lord, have mercy upon us and incline our hearts to keep this law." In time, the parishioners began to associate the keeping of the Fourth Commandment with Sunday observance. Thus, inadvertently, the Church of England had sown the seeds of a Sunday Sabbatarianism. I use the word inadvertently purposely because the Church of England at this point could hardly be described as holding a Sabbatarian position. That can be observed in Hesse's Bampton Lectures, which we've cited in footnote 15, where he titles the use of the Fourth Commandment by the Church of England as a parable. They used it under the parable of the Fourth Commandment, and the various works that came from that period that are cited in that footnote. Official documents of the church. A second factor which promoted the growth of Sabbatarianism lay in the character of the English Reformation as compared with its counterpart on the continent. The Reformation in England was a state matter from the very beginning and carried political overtones which made it different from the German and Swiss Reformation. Now, that is not intended to say that there were no political overtones in the Reformation on the continent, but there was it was a unique situation in England. Henry VIII, in detaching England from the papacy, was not so much motivated by Protestant conviction as by the desire for a divorce and concern for a male heir to the throne. In his political struggle with Rome, Henry established a national church with the crown as its head. The will of the monarch became supreme. Solberg continues, "As a result, the Henrician Reformation raised a problem of religious authority which proved significant in the development of the Sabbatarian movement. Henry erected an independent national church headed by the crown and laid foundations for a comprehensive Anglicanism designed to embrace the entire country." But the Protestant reformers wanted Christianity ruled by some principle other than the divine right of kings. That principle was the divine authority of God's word, sola scriptura, about which we have heard much this week. This principle first expressed itself in England, as it did in Europe, in the concern that the Bible should be translated, printed, and circulated in the vernacular. The work of William Tyndale stands out as a pioneer effort in this enterprise. Though a Bible whose size and price made it available to the masses awaited the publication of the Geneva Bible in 1560. Marian exiles were influential in the putting together of that Geneva Bible. With the Bible in English made available at the beginning of the reign of Elizabeth, Elizabeth's reign, you recall, began in 1558. The careful study of the scriptures to discover its rule of life for the Christian became increasingly one of the concerns of theologians in the Elizabethan era. It is here that a third factor in the rise of Sabbatarianism must be introduced, that is, the influence of Reformed theology. With the accession of Mary to the English throne in July 1553, and the reinstatement of Catholicism, nearly 800 Protestants fled to the continent beginning in January 1554. These Marian exiles, around 200 of which were clergymen or theological students, eventually settled in the German Rhineland and Switzerland, where they came under Reformed influences and especially the thought of John Calvin. While neither Calvin nor the Continental Reformation produced anything closely resembling the Puritan Sabbath, Reformed theology, with its tenet that Old and New Testaments constitute one unbroken covenant, and Calvin's teaching on the third use of the law as the Christian's rule of life, provided fertile soil for the growth of such a doctrine. The exiles received the skeleton of covenant theology, which both they and second-generation Reformed theologians on the continent developed. You can find information in footnote 19 to substantiate that. The experience of the exiles firmly established a Calvinistic and Reformed arm in the English Reformation. And although Elizabeth wanted to strike a course between Rome and Geneva, Geneva was not without its exponents, as the next century of English history clearly proved. When the exiles returned, the Reformed influence, with its emphasis on one covenant uniting both testaments, coupled with the desire to fashion a Christianity based solely on the Word of God, spawned an increasing interest in the Sabbath. This same interest was found among second-generation reformers on the continent who began to teach that the fourth commandment was partly moral and partly ceremonial, and that the essential moral element was one day in seven set aside for worship. So when several German theologians in the 1580s began to emphasize the perpetual moral character of the Sabbath rather than its typical significance, they were enlarging on a well-established Reformed tradition. And their doctrine, says Collinson, if not identical with English Sabbatarianism, approximated to it and provided it with a dogmatic springboard. As an evidence of this continental influence in England, the debates and treatises on the Sabbath from the last two decades of the 16th century contain references to Bullinger, Martyr, Tremelius, Beza, Danaeus, Ursinus, Junius, Zanchius, Wolfius, and others, indicating that the English Sabbatarianism was elaborated in full awareness of the progress of the question in learned circles overseas. Other factors that contributed to an atmosphere conducive to the growth of Sabbatarianism may be mentioned without extensive comment. Article 7 of the 39 Articles of the Church of England, issued in 1571, stated that the Old Testament is not contrary to the New, and that while ceremonial and civil precepts were no longer binding on Christians, quote, no Christian man whatsoever is free from the obedience of the commandments which are called moral. Moreover, the Decalogue began to be singled out and given a place of prominence that it had not known in England prior to this time. Elizabeth ordered that all the Catholic ornaments in chancels were to be replaced with the two tables of the law. And as already observed, the recitation of the Ten Commandments had become a regular part of the liturgy. The Puritans, meanwhile, in keeping with their Reformed heritage, became increasingly noted for demanding specific biblical warrant for their system of thought and code of conduct. William Perkins has already been mentioned in connection with his attempts to relate the scriptures to economic and social affairs. Thomas Cartwright envisioned an entire scheme of jurisprudence based on the Ten Commandments and attempted to revive Mosaic law as a basis for obedience. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? In their attempt to purify the worship of the Church of England of the dregs of popery, the Puritans insisted that the first table of the law was the single most important source declaring the proper norms for the worship of God. which naturally led to their viewing the fourth commandment as the source of binding authority for the observance of the Lord's Day. Let me call your attention again to footnote 25 at the bottom of page 13. This is a rather interesting comment. This book I found very fascinating. J. Sears McGee, The Godly Man in Stuart England, Anglicans, Puritans, and the Two Tables. McGee, on page 70, says this: Puritans tended to emphasize the duties of the first table, whereas Anglicans tended to emphasize those of the second. And he proceeds to give evidence for that thesis through the 17th century in England. However, this emphasis on the first table did not immediately emerge. The Sabbath is a case in point. It appears that Sabbatarian ethics preceded the development of a Sabbatarian theology. While there was a groundswell of opinion favoring a better use of the Lord's Day in the sermons and tracts of the Elizabethan era, it was not until the last 15 years of the century that a careful theological justification of Sunday Sabbatarianism was articulated. Note footnote number 26. Notable among the sermons, which were those preached at Paul's Cross in 1578-79 by John Stockwood and Thomas White, various tracts also appeared addressing the subject of Sabbath abuses. Humphrey Roberts wrote an earnest complaint of diverse vain, wicked, and abused exercises practiced on the Sabbath day, 1572. John Northbrook, in a treatise wherein dicing, dancing, vain plays, or interludes with other idle pastimes, etc., commonly used on the Sabbath day, are reproved, 1577. This is the first person, by the way, known to have enunciated the distinctive tenet of later Puritan thought that the Fourth Commandment is the basis for strict Sunday observance. John Field, in a godly exhortation by occasion of the late judgment of God showed at Paris Garden, 1583, warned his readers that God's judgment would continue to fall on profaners of the Lord's Day as it had on Sunday, January 13, 1583, at the Paris Garden bear baiting pit, where eight people were killed when a gallery collapsed. That same year, Philip Stubbs wrote his popular Jeremiad entitled The Anatomy of Abuses, a book that went through five editions in 13 years. Until then, picking up at the bottom of 14, the biblical authority in the many attempts to regulate the Englishman's Sunday was either assumed or only briefly alluded to. Three names stand out as the spokesman who set forth the doctrinal rationale of the Puritan Sabbath: Lancelot Andrews, Richard Greenham, and Nicholas Baum. Andrews appears to be the first to have formulated this new doctrine. As a fellow of Pembroke Hall, Cambridge, and the catechist of his college, Andrews in the 1580s delivered a series of expository lectures on the Ten Commandments, which attracted large attention. In 1585, lecturing on the Fourth Commandment, he set forth virtually all the ideas which are to be found in the Puritan arguments on this topic for the next century. Years later, when he had left behind this Puritan phase and had become a leading bishop of Anglicanism, Andrews dissociated himself from the Sabbatarian theology that he had articulated at Cambridge. We will have a point of irony with respect to that a little later on. Richard Greenham, who had also been a fellow of Pembroke and a close associate of Andrews, wrote perhaps as early as 1586 a treatise of the Sabbath day, though it was not published until later. Greenham incorporated into his treatise most of the same ideas regarding the Sabbath as set forth in Andrews' Cambridge lectures. Little is known of Nicholas Baum, the man whose name more than any other has been associated with the Puritan Sabbath. He too was educated at Cambridge, was a Puritan of the non-separatist variety, and spent most of his career as an Anglican clergyman at Norton in Suffolk, where he was installed in 1585. In 1611, he became the minister of the Church of St. Andrew the Apostle at Norwich, where he remained until his death in 1613. A fact of more significance is that he came from a family that had a deep concern about the Sabbath. His stepfather was Richard Greenham, whose Sabbath position strongly influenced Baum's thinking. And his brother-in-law was John Decalogue Dodd. I thought it was interesting that the 20th century produced Deputy Dog, and the 17th century produced Decalogue Dodd. Dodd later published a treatise on the Ten Commandments that was quite popular among Puritans. That's about the only group it was popular with, but it was popular with them. Baum's first work, The Doctrine of the Sabbath, 1595, consolidated into a single work all the current thought on the Sabbath and provided a theological rationale for the precise Sabbatarianism which became characteristic of mature Puritanism. The importance with which this book was regarded is evident in the opposition it aroused. Archbishop Whitgift suppressed the work by attempting to call in all the remaining copies, and Lord Chief Justice Popham in 1600 forbade any more copies to be published. But as Thomas Fuller remarked, books are most called on when called in. How we know when books go out of print and there are only three copies left. And the result was that the new doctrine spread faster than ever. Finally, in 1606, after repeated requests from others, Baum produced an expanded edition of his original work, Sabbathum Veteris et Novi Testamenti, and these works together crystallized and standardized Puritan Sabbatarianism. Primus estimates the impact of Baum's work in these words. He, that is Baum, provided just what they, Sabbatarians, needed. An authoritative statement based on divine command for strict Sunday observance. His works offered theological leverage for scrupulous Sabbath keeping. And astonishingly, Sabbatarianism underwent no further development after Baum completed his prodigious works. It sprang full-blown from his pen. Literally, dozens of works were written on the Sabbath in the 50 years following the publication of Baum's first book, but they added virtually nothing. Taken together, his books were the classic and original treatment, the Puritan magnum opus on the Sabbath. In sheer length of treatment, he overwhelmed all the competition. 286 pages in the first edition and a staggering 459 pages on the fourth commandment in the second. Only a Sabbatarian could write that much on the Sabbath. Baum's works included both a Sabbatarian theology and a Sabbatarian ethics. Now, I think it might be at this point well to look at footnote 32, because it is rather interesting that both Andrews and Bound, in their Sabbatarian theology, came very close to making the Sabbath a third sacrament. For example, Primus, in citing Bound, in the footnote cited there in verse 32, says, "We should acknowledge it to be the singular mercy of God towards us in Christ Jesus that he hath given us his Sabbath. Given them to us, I say, who when we were plunged in the bottomless pit of all misery and there pressed down with the weight of our own sins, had no means to be raised out of it again as from the dead, saving his holy word and blessed sacraments, hath together with them given us his Sabbaths. That upon them, we being so fully and altogether occupied in these means, as we should be, and as we cannot be in the other days, because of our callings, might through the blessing of God be made partakers of him who had made of God the Father for us wisdom, righteousness, holiness, and redemption, and so be saved by him." Knappen, in his book Tudor Puritanism, cites Andrews as suggesting the same thing, that Sunday observance was a third sacrament. Days, and so likewise bread and wine, are no more holy of themselves other than one than another, but because they will they be separated and set apart for holy uses. Back up in the text. In relation to Sabbatarian ethics, the practice of compiling a list of what could and could not be done on the Sabbath had come to characterize most of the material on the subject that appeared before Bounds' work. Bounds followed this pattern and gave the most elaborate list published to that time, and in so doing set the course for 17th century Puritanism, which then developed an elaborate Sabbath casuistry. Rules always have exceptions, and exceptions generate more rules. Bound was stricter than earlier writers on the proper observance of the Sabbath, and Bound's successors were stricter than he was. In fact, the growing Sabbath casuistry of the Puritans and their demand that it be sanctioned and enforced as the law of the land makes up a significant portion of the history of the church in England prior to the Civil War, and was a major issue in the growing cleavage between Parliament and the Crown under James I and Charles I. Footnote 33. It is also noteworthy that the proper observance of the Sabbath was an issue in part responsible for the Puritan exodus to the New World. When the second Book of Sports was issued in 1633 by Charles I, many clergymen, including John Cotton, John Davenport, Thomas Hooker, and Thomas Shepherd, immigrated to New England. It was in the face of such conflict that Thomas Shepherd wrote these words: "It's easy to demonstrate by scripture and argument as well as by experience that religion is just as the Sabbath is, and decays and grows as the Sabbath is esteemed. The immediate honor and worship of God, which is brought forth and swaddled in the three first commandments, is nursed up and suckled in the bosom of the Sabbath." That is a typical expression of the Puritan view of the Sabbath. The legacy of the Puritan Sabbath as a seriously defended theological proposition actually begins with the contribution of Andrews, Greenham, and Bound. None of the constituent elements of their Sabbatarian theology was an entirely unheard of novelty, and yet the theory as a whole was a remarkable break with the past. It had received the doctrinal apologetic that it needed to ensure its longevity, and when it was given confessional status in the Westminster Confession of 1646, it was permanently enshrined as an article of faith to be taught, adhered to, discussed, and debated, even to this day. There are two other important mainstreams to be considered in this survey of the rise of modern Sabbatarianism. First is the appearance of Saturday Sabbatarianism in England early in the 17th century. And the second is the relationship of Baptists in England and America to the Sabbath question. One of the most vulnerable points in Bound's Sabbatarian theology was his defense of the change of day from the seventh to the first day of the week. The following extended citation from Primus summarizes the issue well. Bound's explanation of the shift to the first day of the week as the day of rest and worship is not simple. It takes 15 pages of intricate argument, and the paragraph that opens the discussion reveals that sleight of hand necessary for Bound to make his case. "But now concerning this very special seventh day that now we keep in the time of the gospel, that is well known that it is not the same as it was from the beginning, which God himself did sanctify, and whereof he speaketh in this commandment. For it was the day going before ours, which in Latin retaineth his ancient name, and is called the Sabbath, which we also grant, but so that we confess it must always remain, never to be changed any more, and that all men must keep holy this seventh day and none other, which was unto them not the seventh, but the first day of the week, as it is so called many times in the New Testament, and so it is still standeth in force that we are bound unto the seventh day, though not unto the very seventh." Apparently, Bounds is using seventh day in two senses. First, in the sense of the seventh day of the week, or Saturday, and second, in the sense of every seventh day, which could be any day of the week, but which Bounds goes on to tie down specifically to Sunday. when the inherent vulnerability of the change of a day portion of Bound's theory was thoughtfully assessed, it became apparent that if there was any validity to the Sabbatarian argument, the distinct possibility existed that the seventh day should be retained as the Sabbath. The first documented case of Saturday Sabbatarianism was in London in 1617. Hamlet Jackson, a young tailor, became convinced that the fourth commandment required Christians to observe Saturday as the Sabbath. Around 1617, he influenced his Puritan minister, John Trask, to this same view, and Trask began immediately to propagate the doctrine of the Saturday Sabbath. Trask's Sabbatarian ethics reached new levels of legalistic strictness. Lighting fires, preparing meals, sweeping the house, and other things were considered to be morally wrong. The extent to which he drifted toward Judaism is seen in his reinstatement of the Jewish dietary laws and his observance of the Passover. It is ironic that when he was arrested for his heretical views, he was censured by none other than Bishop Lancelot Andrews, who had given impetus to the movement just a few decades earlier in the infamous Star Chamber after he had an eye branded on his forehead. An I standing for a Judaizer. They spelled Judaizer back then with an I. I-U-D-A-I-Z-E-R. Trask later recanted his views in A Treatise of Liberty from Judaism, 1620. You imagine he recanted, he had the I. One of the most able defenders of the seventh-day Sabbath in the 17th century was an Anglican minister of Norwich, Theophilus Braber. In 1628, he published a discourse upon the Sabbath day, which advocated that the Saturday Sabbath should be observed from Saturday morning to bedtime that night. In 1632, he published a larger volume entitled A Defense of That Most Ancient Ordinance of God, the Sabbath Day. He caused no small stir by dedicating this work to Charles I, which led to Charles' demand that a refutation of Braeburn's work be produced, a task undertaken by Francis White in A Treatise of the Sabbath Day, 1635. The records indicate that Charles was not only upset, he was burned when that book was dedicated to him. In the meantime, Braeburn was brought before the Court of High Commission and supposedly recanted. But in his will, he got back at him. He left £10 to a Sabbatarian church in Norwich. It is at this point that Baptists begin to enter the picture, because most of the observers of the seventh-day Sabbath in the 17th century were Baptists. The Baptist Encyclopedia summarizes, in the 16th century, Baptists who kept the seventh day were quite common in Germany. In the beginning of the 17th century, they made their appearance in England, but did not begin to organize churches until 1650. Within 50 years from the latter date, there were 11 Sabbatarian churches in England and scattered Sabbath keepers in many parts of the kingdom. And if the Seventh-day Baptists in Europe and America can be trusted as a source, it was a far greater number than that. Cathcart is being very conservative in his numbers there. The first known Seventh-day Baptist to write a treatise on the Sabbath was James Oxford. In the early 1640s, he published the Doctrine of the Fourth Commandment, which was then ordered to be burned by the authorities of the Church of England. However, in spite of its immediate rejection, Oxford's work was counted worthy of an extended review by Daniel Cawdrey and Herbert Palmer, two members of the Westminster Assembly, who collaborated in 1645 to produce Sabbatum Redivivum, or The Christian Sabbath Vindicated. This two-volume work of over 1,000 pages was the most lengthy defense of Sunday Sabbatarianism ever written by English authors. It is interesting that these men felt their work urgent enough to begin while the Westminster Assembly was still in session, and that it included an extended rebuttal of Saturday Sabbatarianism. In fact, Oxford's book occasioned this comment by Cawdrey and Palmer. It seems the Anabaptists, who usually cry down the Sabbath, either as anti-Christian or ceremonial, began to see the necessity of a Sabbath, and will rather return to the old Sabbath with the Jews than have none at all. This statement is very important. It's very important for two reasons. It reflects the opinion of these Westminster divines that Anabaptists were historically either non-Sabbatarian or Seventh-day Sabbatarian. And furthermore, that these positions emerged in that historical order in England. Moreover, this statement harmonizes with what is known about two Anabaptist mainstreams of the Radical Reformation, each of which produced its own theory on the observance of a day of worship. The larger mainstream, composed primarily of what Williams terms evangelical Anabaptists, held that the New Covenant replaced the Old, and therefore that only the New Testament was normative for doctrine, ethics, and polity. This meant that the fourth commandment of the Decalogue was not literally binding, and in keeping with their typical interpretation of the Old Testament, they taught that the present Christian life was a perpetual spiritual Sabbath. Furthermore, since neither Christ nor the apostles anywhere commanded the observance of a special day of rest or worship, none was binding. The second mainstream, composed primarily of what is termed revolutionary Anabaptists, regarded both Old and New Testaments alike as normative for the theology and government of the church. They further taught that since the Decalogue was completely moral, the Seventh-day Sabbath was still in force. Oswald Blake and Andrew Fisher propagated this form of Anabaptism in Silesia and Moravia in 1528. The contrary positions of these two Anabaptist mainstreams spilled over into the 17th century and find their continued expression among English Baptists. Now, I'd like to make a point that is observed in footnote 47. These positions on the Lord's Day, or on a day of worship, common in these Anabaptist mainstreams, it should be noted, do not seem to follow other divisional lines among Baptists, especially the distinction between general and particular Baptists that emerged in 17th century England. For example, in 1676, Francis Bamfield organized the Pinner's Hall Seventh-day Baptist Church, rather than joining with the old established Mill Yard Seventh-day Baptist Church because of a difference over Calvinism. Bamfield had been a Puritan before becoming a Seventh-day Baptist, and had such a commitment to his Calvinism that not even the Sabbath was sufficient to bridge the gap with Arminianism. 17th century English Baptist positions on the observance of a day of worship were typically either non-Sabbatarian or Seventh-day Sabbatarian, until the restoration of Charles II, when a Sunday Sabbatarianism emerged among particular Baptists in London, which was given confessional status in the Second London Confession of 1677 after the pattern of the Westminster Confession of 1646. This writer was unable to find any evidence of English Baptists holding a Sunday Sabbatarian position before the time of the Second London Confession. The First London Confession of 1644 and its subsequent editions in 1646, 1651, 52, said nothing at all about the Sabbath. Lumpkin explains this rather sudden appearance of the uncharacteristically Baptist Sunday Sabbath among particular Baptists in this way. The renewal of persecution, and here I left out a bracket, so you need to insert a bracket before the word by and after the date 1673. Of persecution by the English government in 1673, brought dissenting groups nearer to one another and especially brought Baptists and Congregationalists nearer to Presbyterians. Defiance of the Conventicle Act by the large Presbyterian party, which had been the dominant ecclesiastical group under the Commonwealth, made enforcement of that act all but impossible. Observing the success of the Presbyterians, other dissenters were emboldened. Moreover, it was important that dissenters form a united front, which might be demonstrated by a show of doctrinal agreement among themselves. The very document which would be a best proof of this agreement on essential matters was at hand, the Westminster Confession. This confession had been prepared by the Westminster Assembly and published in 1646 and had become the official confession of Scotland, had been adopted by the English Parliament with slight alteration, and was still the authoritative creed of English Presbyterians. Also, Congregationalists had adopted it as their confession after making some changes in conformity with their views of the church at the Savoy Conference in 1658. The particular Baptists of London and vicinity determined, therefore, to show their agreement with Presbyterians and Congregationalists by making the Westminster Confession the basis of a new confession of their own. A circular letter was sent to particular Baptist churches in England and Wales asking that representatives be sent to a general meeting in 1677. By the time this meeting was held, it appears that Elder William Collins of the Petty France Church in London had worked over the Westminster document, altering it as he saw fit. At the meeting, the products of Collins' labors were approved and the confession was issued in the name of the gathered representatives. There were numerous and marked differences between this confession and that of 1644. To be sure, certain phrases were taken from the former confession, and there were evidences that other reminiscences from it were included. But nevertheless, a number of significant and far-reaching changes were made. Among the innovations were the treatment of such subjects as the Scriptures, the Sabbath, and marriage. Now, even if Lumpkin is only partially true in stating that persecution caused dissenters to rally around the Westminster Confession in the interest of presenting a doctrinal consensus, the prior history of Baptists in Europe and England is clear. Sunday Sabbatarianism was not a characteristic Baptist position. If Lumpkin is right, and this writer has found nothing to discredit his account, Sunday Sabbatarianism only became a Baptist position among those who had rejected a Seventh-day position as they perceived Puritan Presbyterianism to be a powerful ally in the common struggle against English authorities who had become intent on suppressing dissent and establishing uniformity in religion. And I'd like to make a comment or two about the Seventh-day Baptists. In footnote 49, I've given some information in relative to them. The number of Seventh-day Baptists in England increased very rapidly in the second half of the 17th century. Their numbers were not as much in the first half. A large number of the radical Fifth Monarchy movement during the Puritan Protectorate either were or would later become Seventh-day Baptists. In 1657, two of these Fifth Monarchy men, William Salar — there's some question as to how his name is pronounced or the spelling, Sellers — and John Spittlehouse, published an appeal to the consciences of the chief magistrates of this commonwealth touching the Sabbath day, in which they urged the legal sanctioning of the observance of the seventh-day Sabbath. Cromwell saw the Fifth Monarchy movement as a dangerous attempt to govern England by Old Testament law. Isn't it interesting that Cromwell would say that? And rejected their attempt to set up the judicial law of Moses in abrogation of all our administrations. My, they must have been radical. Other Fifth Monarchy men — by the way, you know how they got their name, don't you? They got their name, they viewed themselves prophetically. Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, you have four great world empires. They saw themselves as those who were going to bring in the kingdom of Christ, the fifth great world empire. So they saw themselves, you see, the Fifth Monarchy. They were its spokesmen, and they were the ones whom God had appointed to bring it in. And so they interpreted all of those passages in Daniel and Revelation as referring to them. Other Fifth Monarchy men who were Seventh-day Baptists were Dr. Peter Chamberlain, a surgeon, John James, John Belcher, Thomas Tillam, and Christopher Pooley. If you want to read some interesting history, read the story of Thomas Tillam. Two of the most notable Seventh-day Baptists of this period, though not Fifth Monarchists, were Francis and Thomas Bampfield. Bampfield, in fact, served under the Cromwellian Protectorate as an official. Seventh-day Baptists produced numerous treatises in defense of the Saturday Sabbath in the final years of the 17th century. I must have run across, on microfilm, some 25 treatises that were written on the subject of the Seventh-day Sabbath by Seventh-day Baptists in the last half of the 17th century. Years later, in America, where a constitution had been recently ratified which guaranteed a liberty of conscience in religious matters, the concession to a Sunday Sabbath in the Second London Confession was questioned. The Philadelphia Baptist Association had in 1742 officially adopted the Second London Confession, having added articles on psalm singing and the laying on of hands. The minutes of this association in the years subsequent to the adoption of this confession contain a series of circular letters written to introduce a topic of discussion for that year among the member churches of the association. In 1798, Reverend David Jones penned a letter on the subject of religious worship and the Sabbath day. A portion of Jones' letter is here quoted. We now proceed to observe a few things with respect to the time of performing religious worship. We are taught that God is a spirit and must be worshipped in spirit and in truth, and that we should pray without ceasing. Yet it is necessary to have in the churches fixed times for public worship. And it is to be wished that all Christians were unanimous on this subject, but there is little hope of this being the case till we drop all traditions and traditional modes of speech, for these things will cause many mistakes. The compilers of our Confession of Faith were desirous to use the same language with other Christians. That's in 1798, affirming what Lumpkin said, as far as was thought consistent with a good conscience. And it may be on this subject they can form more than can be supported by the Holy Scriptures, or any arguments justly drawn from them. Should we express ourselves in a manner different from them, we are in hopes it will give no offense to any of our brethren. And we are rather persuaded the manner in which we shall treat this subject will be generally acceptable if the arguments are calmly considered. Would that that would characterize our situation today. We shall inquire into two points relative to the subject, Jones writes, whether the fourth commandment was moral or ceremonial, and by what authority Christians observed the first day of the week as a day of worship. Jones then proceeds to develop his position that the Sabbath commandment was a ceremonial institution binding only on the nation of Israel. Insofar as the New Testament church is concerned, the Old Testament Sabbath, signifying rest, contains in it a picture of that rest which a soul enjoys when enabled to believe in Christ. Perhaps more significant is the fact that Jones felt the liberty to question his Baptist confession of faith. Not because of a critical spirit, but because of a concern for the truth. His questioning grew out of the recognition that confessions are the products of men, and therefore must not be regarded as superior or equal to the Scriptures, and may in time come to be seen as in need of refinement and revision. It is the writer's prayer that this same spirit will prevail among Baptists in the 20th century, whose conviction it is that the recovery of vital New Testament Christianity as it relates to the study of historical theology entails the labor of laying hold of the truth as it has been developed and preserved in not just one, but several theological mainstreams down through church history. Thank you.